relationship between science and Christianity. And I kind of want to point out that a lot of what you probably have been told in school and you've heard in sort of the popular culture and popular media ain't true. You've been basically fibbed to in a lot of ways. We all have. Because the relationship between science and faith is not what you think maybe it has been. So to preface this, I want to talk about just a very brief overview tonight, looking at how our culture has viewed historically the relationship between science and Christianity specifically. And this is often viewed in terms of a conflict model. If you remember, we talked about the relationships, four different ways of looking at the relationship between science and faith. And the first one was what we call the conflict model. Remember that? Where there's either science that's right or there's Christianity. There's faith that's right. And the two simply do not get along. One basically eclipses the other. And what we have seen, really, I think, in modern culture has been shaped by what we call the warfare metaphor with regard to science and Christianity. The fact that they're at war. And particularly, we've been told that Christianity has waged war on science. And that science has been valiantly defending itself against the ignorance of religion, and particularly Christianity. So we see that science and Christianity are in conflict. Interesting thing, though, is that this viewpoint did not really come into being as a common or a prevalent view in society until the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And this is because there were two major books put out that established officially what we call the warfare metaphor or conflict between Christianity and science. Two important works by two fairly well-known men. First is William Draper. William Draper wrote a book, The History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. It was published in 1874. So, I mean, this goes way back. This is just after the Civil War. Okay. The second one is by Mr. Dixon White, Andrew Dixon White, who published The History of Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. And this came out in 1896, just before the turn of the century. And I'm going to really talk just very briefly, particularly with regard to White's work, because I think his probably was the more influential. Basically, these two guys were of the opinion, because of their worldview, that Christianity and science were fundamentally incompatible. And that science had gotten to where it was at the time of the writing only by pushing aside the ignorance of Christianity. And that it actually had to overcome the biases and the ignorance of Christianity. And in these two works, they cite example after example after example of times when honest, hardworking scientists had to overcome persecution and abuse and basically stumbling blocks thrown their way by the ignorant Christians. Now, it turns out that in the last 40 years, historians of science have gone back and reevaluated these works. And they basically found them to be, basically, the technical term is hooey. They have been discredited pretty much across the board by both Christian and secular historians of science. These two guys, interestingly, had an axe to grind. I'm not going to go into all the details of why, but they had bad experiences with Christianity. And they decided that they would basically develop what we call a polemic. Anybody know what a polemic is? Polemic writing? A polemic writing is basically some treatise, all right? Some writing that seeks to discredit or destroy a particular point of view. Not necessarily to support a point of view, but primarily to discredit or destroy a point of view. These two guys have been recognized as really polemicists, all right? There maybe is some argument that can be made for polemic argument, but not a lot. Basically, you're just looking to take somebody's knees out from under them and not really do anything constructive in the process. What I'm going to talk about tonight is to counter what these men basically espoused. One that science pushed its way up through the ignorance of the Dark Ages. And the Dark Ages were the result of Christianity. And that great men along the way, great men of science, had to fight their way through the church to do good science. So what I'm going to do tonight is look at some specific examples in history about how science and faith have worked, with the idea that I want to lay out for you good reasons why you can feel comfortable that Christianity actually is a friend of science rather than an enemy. Okay? That we have an historic reason for saying Christianity walks side by side with science. We haven't always agreed on everything, right? But we have not been fundamentally enemies. Interestingly enough, by the way, I should point out that Mr. White was the founder of Cornell University and is very highly thought of, even though his work was discredited. So the true history of science and Christianity will begin in the middle, or what's often been referred to as the Dark Ages. And there's discussion about exactly the dates where it starts and it stops. But to encompass all of it, about 300 to 1300 A.D. The first myth is that really the Dark Ages happened because of Christianity. Now, if you've ever watched movies about that time period, you know, you see all these people walking around, the monks, right? And you hear the Gregorian chants. And what do you notice about the surroundings? Any movie or story about the Middle Ages, it's dirty. It's miserable. It's smelly. Okay, it's dirtier and smellier than we probably are. but just pretty grim. Pretty rough. And the image that has been built in our cultural mindset is that Christianity and primitive existence put together, yes, ignorant, scratching Christians, you know. All right? Well, I would submit to you that Christianity did not cause the Dark Ages, nor did it prolong them. And a lot of people say, well, fall of the Roman Empire, we realize that Christianity was made the state religion of Rome, right? Under who? Anybody know? Any history buffs? Who? Constantine, yeah. Constantine declared Christianity the state religion. And there are those, and I believe that probably Mr. White would say that that was the beginning of the downfall, the degeneration of the Roman Empire. And the collapse of the Roman Empire is really what we recognize today as giving rise to the Dark or the Middle Ages. But there are a lot of reasons, actually, that the Roman Empire failed and ultimately collapsed. First of all, the Roman culture itself was on a long downward spiral to decay. We see emperors like Caligula and a few other choice emperors who took their authority I warn you, I spit when I talk, who had ultimate authority in their hands, were not afraid to use it for personal gain. And this string of corruption that went from emperor to emperor to emperor ultimately resulted in a populace that was being controlled largely through bread and circuses. At the heart of the Roman Empire towards its downfall, really, there was one great big building that was central to every major Roman city. What do you think it was? There's a Colosseum. What happened in the Colosseum? Killing of Christians? Yeah. Before Constantine, I might say. But gladiators. Even after Constantine, gladiatorial games continued, blood sport. Life was cheap and was getting cheaper by the year. The emperors and those under them sought to control the populace. They would give away free bread at these things. Now, they would be pillaging the country's treasury to build these great big colosseums and monuments to themselves. They'd be destroying the economy of the nation, but would appease the populace by games and bread and other such things. And along with this, of course, the populace itself became more hardened, became more degenerate, and basically, yeah, looks a lot like some of the U.S. today, unfortunately. So in time, what happened is we had total societal decay, and along with that, you have a loss of military power because self-discipline goes out the window, right? And the country really is no longer capable of defending itself. The second aspect was that there were several plagues in the first and second centuries that decimated large parts of the Roman Empire. The large cities is where these outbreaks would occur. Of course, this is where commerce goes on, learning, where innovation occurs, and these plagues basically would destroy large parts of the population, and they would have to rebuild. And every time they rebuilt, it was never quite what it was before. Interestingly enough, there are some scholars that believe that the Roman Empire, one of the factors that led to the downfall of the Roman Empire, was their love of lead pipes in getting water. Roman cities were amazing. They had aqueducts. They had running water in a lot of the more expensive homes. They had these baths. The walls actually had pipes running through them with heated water, so their houses were warm and remarkable. But the water that they drank also came from these lead pipes. And they believed that the aristocracy, the highborn, were drinking this leaded water and may have had lead poisoning, which, by the way, leads to dementia, which would explain a lot of their emperors, I would think. Some of their behaviors were absolutely outrageous, not just brutal, but just strange. And so we believe there was some component of organic disease in here. The Romans also were fond of going out, conquering people, and then conscripting them to serve in the Roman army. So if you were some poor guy from Gaul and you were overrun by the Roman army, not only did you get captured, your lands get taken and everything else, but you were told, now you got to fight for the Roman army. And the way they treated these conscripts was not very good. These conscripts actually had to buy their own weapons and armor and had to buy their own food. It's not like the U.S. military where when you go into the military, they give you those really snazzy khakis, yeah? Everybody wants to wear one of those. You know, you look good, right? They give you your weapon, they train you, and then they even pay you a little bit. We got it easy. These Roman conscripts did not get that particular kind of treatment, and particularly if they were of a conquered people. One of the things the Romans did, and what they were known for, was taking conquered peoples and making them the spearhead of attacks against an enemy. Not training them all that well, because it was kind of expensive to train them. Use them as human cannon fodder, so that the enemy would use up its energy killing the conscripts. And then the regular Roman army, the guys with the tall tower shields and the feather hats and the, you know, all the brass and the scarlet, could march in and clean up as they walked over the bodies of the conscripts. So this did not win the Roman government any love by conquered peoples. And the people that were conquered, that were staying in the lands, those people that were not conscripted, were not happy about this. One of the stories of the fall of Rome and the sacking of Rome was the story of Alaric the First, the king of the Visigoths. The Visigoths had been chased out of their homeland by the Huns. You know Attila? Yeah? Same guy. He was moving westward and terrifying everybody in his path. And the only thing that stood between the Visigoths and the Huns was the Roman Empire. And so the Visigoths went to the Romans and said, "Look, we'll work for you. We will be your soldiers. Just protect us from the Huns. Give us equipment, but more importantly, give us food." Because they were starving. They'd been chased out of their lands. They had lost all of their food in the process. And they knew that at least the Romans might feed them. The Romans said, "Fine." And then promptly reneged in the deal and let hundreds of thousands of Visigoths starve to death in the process. This set in motion, ultimately, the sack of Rome in 410 by King Alaric I of the Visigoths. He rallied his people. He went in and slaughtered as many Romans as he could find and marched his way right to the gates of Rome and then sacked it, destroyed it, burned it. And that was when Rome finally fell. It paid the price for its arrogance. And by the way, do you think Christian principles were involved in Rome's behavior? I don't think so. I don't think so. But the argument still stands that, well, somehow Christian influences caused the fall of Rome. Interestingly enough, if you remember, Rome was divided at the end of the Roman era into two parts. There was a western part that was ruled from Rome and an eastern part that was ruled from Constantinople. All right, we had an eastern empire and a western empire. The eastern empire lasted considerably longer than the western empire, but the eastern empire was devoutly Christian. And if we look here, I don't know if the orange is the Eastern Empire. I don't know if you can see right up there, just below the word Thrace, is Constantinople, which was the capital of the Eastern Empire. So the Western Empire fell, and the Eastern Empire, which was Christian, at least outwardly, not everybody was a believer, but it had very strong Christian influences, survived. And by the way, they were the ones that were a little bit closer to the Huns than the Western Empire. So the argument that Christianity really had a strong influence in the fall of Rome doesn't hold water. What we really find out is that Christianity is actually responsible for saving Western civilization as we know it. Because they saved the knowledge of the Western Empire. The people that did the work were all associated with the Roman Catholic Church, or the early forms of the Roman Catholic Church. The church scribes, the monastic orders, they were primarily interested in saving scriptures. All right? And maintaining the holy writings. But not just that, they were also interested in preserving what Western knowledge there was, particularly in copying Latin texts that were translations from Greek philosophers, such as Aristotle and Plato. Interestingly enough, Aristotle in particular had a tremendous impact on early church thinking. Aristotelian philosophy was the way that the early church thought as they approached Scripture, which led to some errors, because Aristotle had some good ideas with regard to logic and debate and a lot of aspects of looking at the physical world, but he was also really wrong in a lot of ways. Greek thought, for example, led to the error of Gnosticism. Okay? Gnosticism, one of the aspects of Gnosticism is this flesh is evil. Flesh is evil. Spirit is good. We want to get rid of the flesh. We want to be purely spirit. We want to be one with God. This is bad. What does Scripture say about the creation? When God made creation, he looked at it. What did he say? He said it was good, right? It was good. When he looked at the whole thing, he said it was very good. That included the physical. Okay, so Aristotle was not right in everything, but there was useful parts of it. And the early church scribes and monastic orders did a lot to preserve that knowledge. But we also absorbed, the church absorbed a lot of Aristotelian thinking as well. You think of the Dark Ages, as they're called, and you think, pretty primitive. Mud, thatched roofs, you know, just disgusting living conditions, yeah? Well, it turns out, technology moved on. There were some pretty important developments. Now, okay, we're not talking iPods here. You might not think these are important, the development of horse collars and stirrups, but when your entire economy is based on the horse and what the horse can do for you, this is fundamentally big stuff. Okay? Obviously, horse collars would allow you to team horses, to do things like pull wagons, things like that. Stirrups allowed people to stand in a saddle and swing a sword. So direct military application there. It improved warfare, whether that's a good thing in some people's minds. It's a question, yeah. But nevertheless, technology did move forward. People were thinking of things. Things were developing. There were developments in art and literature. I'll mention literature here. One great piece, for those of you that are medieval scholars, one great piece of medieval literature that just about everybody knows here. You might want to... Chaucer was Middle Ages. That was getting closer to the Renaissance, but it was the tail end of the Middle Ages. Yep. I'm thinking of a great epic. Beowulf. Beowulf, right? Anybody read Beowulf here? Okay. So we're talking a literate audience. You want to come to college? I could use a few of you, if you wouldn't mind. This is good. This is good. Yeah. Great literature came out of the Dark Ages. Okay? Not only that, come on, let's go. There we go. This. Come on. There we go. Can't figure out how to do my PowerPoints. The artistry of this area, of this era, was amazing. As a matter of fact, this surprised the British government. About 5 years ago, this guy was out in his field in England, and he was a hobbyist. Just, he had his metal detector, and he liked to go out and just look around his pasture and see if he could find stuff. And he's going out with his metal detector, and he gets a hit, and he reaches down, and he pulls up this ring. This ring, I think, dated back to something like 600 or 700 A.D. Absolutely amazing. Look at the work on this. All these pieces that you're seeing right here came from this man's pasture. There was like 800 different pieces. Look at the quality of the coinage. Up on the right-hand side, that piece there that has the red and the Celtic knots in it, those are rubies, that's gold. That's a sword pommel. Fits on the end of a sword. The other stuff, I'm not sure what the thing with the two pointy things is, but there was a lot of it. And this completely revolutionized our understanding of what artisans and craftsmen in the Middle Ages were capable of. Seems that Christianity maybe wasn't too much of a hindrance on these folks. They had lost civilization in the Roman Empire. It had collapsed. But out of this, there were still some amazing things going on. Oh, and by the way, a lot of this treasure, they believe, was belonged to a Christian king, because there were crosses on some of the gold pieces and on a couple of sword pommels that were gold. If you could afford to put gold on your sword, you were doing pretty good. We weren't talking just, you know, ugly old iron and copper stuff. We're talking rubies and gold. So because of that, really, the term dark has been replaced in favor of the term Middle Ages, going from ancient up to the Renaissance, because really, things maybe weren't quite as bad as we were led to believe. Let's go. Come on. So, moving into the Renaissance. As the church developed, there were a set of views that the church held that were particularly important in the development of science as we know it today. And they are the following. Number one, God is rational. Okay? He is lawful. And he is orderly. Someone wants to read 1 Corinthians 14, 33 and 40. I hope I got this right, because last time I did this, I ended up cutting and pasting the wrong. If anybody gets it, read it really loud. 14:33. You got her? Well, it was 40, because it doesn't even go to 40. There we go. Thank you. I have no idea what I was cutting and pasting there. I have no idea where 40 came from. But yes. Now, this is in contrast to the other gods in the West, or in the rest of the world, particularly if we stop to think of the Greek and the Roman gods. What were the Greek and Roman gods like? Anybody know? They were capricious. Excellent term. At a whim. They just do anything because it felt good. They were particularly nasty. They had every fault that you and I have, except magnified lots of times. You know? If they were really bad, they were really, really, really bad. If they wanted to be obnoxious, they'd make the whole world suffer. There was intrigues. It was a big soap opera. One god was always trying to stick it to another god, and the goddesses were out there making the gods' lives miserable. And you had Hercules fighting his father and his mother and everybody else, and it was a terrible view, really. And because of that view, and you couldn't trust the gods, they weren't orderly, they weren't reasonable, they weren't rational. And they affected the world. Zeus was a god of thunder, lightning. Helios was a god of the sun. If any of them just got angry, well, you'd see these massive changes in the natural world. Does that mean you could really study the natural world easily if all your natural laws changed because a god was ticked off? It makes studying nature really hard if you couldn't trust what nature was going to do in the next 5 minutes. So this is an important concept for us because this lays the foundation for us to be able to understand the natural world. Secondly, imago Dei. What does this mean? In the image of God. Man is made in the image of God. And because we are made in the image of God, we reflect some of God's attributes. If God is rational and orderly, shouldn't we be rational and orderly? We have capacity, yeah, to be rational and orderly. I left out lawful because of what we are, yeah? We tend not to be lawful, but God is. So we are created in the image of God. We don't have to go and read that. We all know what that scripture says. Come on. Since all creation, since what God made is good, it's appropriate then that we discover what is good and to use what is good wherever it's found. All right? It's entirely appropriate. Right? Fourth point, man was given dominion over the earth. Actually, in that part of Genesis where it says you will subdue the earth, it literally means to put your foot on the neck of. I believe the term is shamah in the Hebrew. To put it under your foot, to control it. All right? To have dominion. But to effectively subdue and control the world, we need to understand it. Therefore, inference is science is a legitimate pursuit. Understanding the world is a legitimate thing we can do because of who we are, how God made us, and who God is. All right? So, the world itself is orderly and rational because God is. That means it's understandable. And because it's good, we should pursue it. It's a good thing to go after. We've looked at scripture that says, go to the ant. Right? Learn something from that. We are called to subdue it. But to subdue it, we have to understand it. And ergo, science is a legitimate pursuit. So these are the foundations that Christianity gives to the development of science. No other religious system provides those bases for scientific development. Not animism, all right, where God is in everything and is responsible for changing things as he moves through the physical world. You can't count on anything. All other religious systems fail to give this strong foundation. And this is one of the reasons why science grew out of a Judeo-Christian tradition. During the Renaissance, you're familiar with a major player of Renaissance science, and we're going to talk about Galileo. Okay? Yes, I heard this. Yeah, Galileo. There have been a lot of stories about Galileo's contributions to our understanding of the world. And he was great. We're going to talk about him in detail here. But I want to preface this by saying that this argument, what we call the geocentric versus the heliocentric view of the solar system, is sort of the poster child for the argument that science had to fight Christianity to get on level ground and to be heard. Because a lot of people pivot off of this. This is one of the most common misconceptions, myths, lies, ain't true, that there is, that people get told. So we're going to talk about this particular aspect. There are other stories and other aspects of science that also support my thesis. But this is the one that I think most people would be familiar with. there are two major views about how the solar system was structured. One said that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and the Sun orbits around the Earth, and all the other planets then orbit out in further rings, concentric rings. Okay? This was the view that was really held for quite a long time, and this was called the Ptolemaic view of the solar system. Okay? So named because the person that gets the credit for spreading it the most, and actually the most recognizable name, is Ptolemy of Alexandria, and he lived from 85 to 165 A.D., moving up in the timeline as the Roman Empire was beginning its long descent, and he held that the Earth was at the center of the solar system. Interestingly enough, he did not come up with the idea. Anybody want to take a guess who came up with a geocentric or Earth-centered solar system? We've actually already mentioned him. You might be kind of surprised. No, he was the other guy. He was on the other side of the argument. Now, this was actually a long time before Ptolemy showed up. It was Aristotle. Aristotelian philosophy said that the Earth was at the center of the universe. Not just the solar system, the whole universe. All right? And everything else rotated around the Earth. Now, this is interesting. There's a little philosophy here. Because Aristotle was a philosopher, and he built all of his discussions about the physical world around his philosophy. Now, this was before empiricism, where we look at the natural world and make observations and then test it. Aristotle thought we could just think our way through it. Don't really test it. We can look at things, but no, we're not really. We want to fit what we see to our philosophy and not the other way around. That's the way he thought. Well, and notice, almost 400 years before Ptolemy shows up. So this has been around a long time. What are some of the implications of this, and what's some of the philosophy? Number one, the universe is nested in a series of spheres. The Earth is in the middle, and then around that is the orbit of the moon, and then around the Earth and the orbit of the moon is then the planet Mercury, and then Venus, and I think the Sun. I've got a picture of this here. But there are concentric circles of the Sun and the other planets orbiting around the Earth. The Earth is stationary. Some of the planets are orbits. The stars are in a sphere, another concentric sphere, around all the planets. So there are these layers, like an onion, okay, that the universe is structured on. Heavenly bodies are perfect. All right? This is an important philosophical point. Remember Greek thinking? Aristotelian thinking says, ooh, physical stuff, bad. Heaven, spiritual, good. And because of that notion, all heavenly bodies were perfect. Nothing wrong with them. We're going to find out. Not so, yeah? The orbits are in perfect circles because they believed that the circle was a perfect figure. All right? And if the heavens are perfect and the circle is a perfect figure, then the planets and everything else must operate in perfect circles. We later found out, tain't the case. Orbits are not perfect circles, but they are what? Elliptical, which means that they're kind of oblong, and they run like this. Okay? Keep that in the back of your head. It's an important point. The heavens are indeed changeless. They are static. If you're perfect, and you're going to stay perfect, that means you're not going to change any, are you? Come on. There we go. So if we look at the Ptolemaic model, this is what it looks like. I think the sun is the third orbit out. And what's not shown here is the sphere of the stars. And these were believed to be perfect crystalline spheres that held each of these components. Okay? Now, I should point out that this was not dreamed up just because somebody said, well, I think that's the way it is. Because we didn't have the technology back then that we do now, all you could do was really kind of look at stuff and see if it made sense according to your philosophy. So why did people think this was the case? Well, there are several reasons. The sun looked very small in the sky, yeah? And it looked like it moved, right? I mean, if you're standing on the earth and you, here's east, and the sun comes up, and you don't move, what do you assume is happening? You think the sun is moving, yeah? If you're holding still and it moves across the sky. Sure. The earth felt stationary. Can you feel the earth moving at this point? Do you know that you're spinning and orbiting? Ah. Now, this was before Newton, who came up with his laws, right, of motion. This didn't even come into people's heads. Movement of the earth would create a great wind blowing everything off the earth. You know, you spin that thing up real good and the wind starts moving, nothing would be left. So we're here. We haven't been blown off. The earth can't be spinning. All right? All bodies fall to the center of the universe. Now, what does this imply? Well, if you are on one side of the earth and drop a ball, it's going to fall straight down, perpendicular, right, to the plane of the earth. And if it just kept going, if it was allowed to go, it would go eventually to the center of the earth, yeah? No matter where you drop that ball, it's going to fall to the center of the earth. And the theory was that all objects fell to the center of the earth, or to the center of the universe, and if everything also falls to the center of the earth must be the center of the universe. So it's in the middle of everything. Okay? Another aspect was that as people looked at stars, they didn't appear to change position relative one to another. All right? Due to what we call parallax. Anybody know what parallax is? We got some optical people here. Okay, go for it. It looks like it moves, doesn't it? It's based on an apparent displacement or difference. And now everybody's going. Difference in the apparent position of an object viewed along two different lines of sight. Now, you remember when this was developed around the time of Aristotle, these principles, all you had were your eyeballs. And you could look up at stars, and they would move across the sky at night. They could tell. They were smart back then. By the way, don't think that because these folks didn't understand at all that they were dumb. These were brilliant people, and they did amazing things with just their eyes. But they would watch the stars, and the stars would wheel across the sky, and they would keep track of two of the stars, and the two stars would remain in the same relationship. And so they figured that if we're at the center here and the stars are rotating in an orbit, that it must be that they're rotating around us, yeah? The problem was their parallax was so small because they couldn't blow up the stars. They couldn't magnify the stars large enough to see that distance change as the Earth was moving through its own orbit. With telescopes, we can see that now, that those stars do change. It looks like they get closer and then they get farther apart. They get closer and they get farther apart, depending on what part of the Earth's orbit we're in, because our position is changing relative to theirs, and that's where the parallax comes in. They couldn't see that. So they assumed then that the Earth was stationary and everything else was moving around it. Spinning the Earth would basically flick us all off into the ozone. And since we're not floating off in the ether, all right. They also said that the Earth was really spinning, was rotating on its axis. Part of this was also axis rotation. But if you fired an arrow up and the Earth rotated underneath it, it would land to the west of where you originally shot. Well, that makes sense, yeah. And they said, no, I could shoot straight up, and if I don't move, it would go right through my head. It didn't do that. So they said, the Earth is holding still. All right? And finally, birds and clouds would drift westward. Now, this view held for almost, well, three quarters of two millennia, 1,500 years. It's a long time for ideas to get entrenched, isn't it? And for people to accept it. It made sense. An interesting aspect to this was the argument that Christianity supported the idea that the Earth was at the center of the universe because man was the most important thing out there. And therefore, we were at the heart of everything. Do we have a problem with thinking that God thinks we're about the most special thing going? I don't have a problem with that. He says we are that important because he sent his son to die for us. That makes us the most important thing in creation. Wouldn't you agree? So I have no problem with the idea of holding a special place in God's heart. The most important place in God's heart. All right? Is that really why the church supposedly fought so hard to keep the earth at the center of the universe? No. Not really. Here's a funny thing about this Greek philosophy. It was believed that four elements made up the natural world: air, earth, fire, and water. Earth was the most dense of all these elements. And so was kind of like being in a sinkhole. And that it was believed that all the detritus of the universe fell to the center of the universe. All the junk, all the garbage would fall to Earth because it was material. Material is bad. Flesh is bad. Spirit is good. So really, being at the center of the universe was not a good place to be. It's like living in the city dump. That's really, philosophically, what it meant. Because the heavens are better than we are. Anything that comes down here, well, sort of junk. It's like living at the city dump. The argument that people wanted to hang on to that philosophically because we were special, it doesn't hold true. Actually, Aristotelian philosophy said it was just the opposite. So that was the geocentric model, what was believed for about 1,500 years, and some of the philosophy behind it and the consequences behind it. I now want to talk about the other alternative, all right, which is called the heliocentric. Helios from the Greek god of the sun, okay? It's funny, we use Greek gods to name things. We don't believe in them, but we use them to name things. The heliocentric model first got traction with a guy by the name of Nicholas Copernicus. Nicholas was Polish, and interestingly enough, he was a man of faith. He was a believer. He was a cleric in the Catholic Church, an officer called a canon, and he was assigned to a cathedral. And Copernicus suggested that the sun was central and the earth orbited around it because he noticed that there were problems associated with the lunar cycle that didn't quite make sense with a geocentric model, that with his observations of the movement of the moon and the phases of the moon, it didn't quite add up. And so he said, you know, I think the Earth is moving, and I think the sun is stationary. All right? Now, he didn't really publish much of his work. He did some. He didn't say a lot about it because he was afraid of ridicule. Because for 1,500 years, every philosopher and person who looked at the heavens simply assumed that the Earth was at the center. He wasn't so much afraid of persecution as he was he just didn't want to be laughed at. And so he really did not push his theory. An interesting thing about his theory, though, is that it kept the old Ptolemaic view that the orbits of the planets were still circular, which caused problems. That if you took his theory, even though the sun was the center, if circular orbits existed, it didn't match up with what we saw looking at various planets in their movements. So we still had some problems. We still had a little ways to go with old Nick. Oh, and there he is. He looks like he's got a secret to tell or something. I like this picture. It's either that or something smells really bad. Another proponent of a heliocentric arrangement of our solar system was Johannes Kepler. He deduced that orbits were not circular, but they were elliptical, which is true. And he probably had the clearest vision of how things worked of anybody, including Galileo. And he actually said that, I think, based on my measurements of the moon's phases, and if my geocentric model is correct, that the rise and the fall of the seas, and what we call tides, twice daily, high tides, were the result actually of the moon exerting force on the Earth, gravitational force, so that the side of the Earth that the moon is on is pulling the oceans toward it and causing the sea levels to rise. All right? And that happens twice a day. All right? So that makes sense. Interesting thing about Johann is that he was a man of deep faith. He was actually driven by faith. I love this quote. I wanted to be a theologian. For a long time, I was unhappy. Now God is praised by my work, even in astronomy. I like this guy. He really, what made him really look at elliptical orbits instead of circular orbits? Well, number one, circular orbits didn't explain some of the strange anomalies with regard to planetary movement that he saw. But his real motivation for coming up with ellipses was that God has ordered things in a very special way, and God doesn't tolerate error. And therefore, the theory must be wrong. And he wanted to demonstrate that Copernicus's model was wrong because it didn't honor God in the fact that it was wrong. And that's what drove his understanding of ellipses and why he proposed elliptical orbits. He did not get a lot of play, by the way. Kepler, we now know, was the father of what we call the laws of planetary motion. What he described, we still hold on today. That's the reason why we can put a man on the moon. We understand how the moon moves because Johannes got it right way back then. And we recognize that he understood the true nature of planetary movement. Now we get to the meat of it. The guy I really want to spend time on, because he is the poster child for understanding really the true relationship between science and faith, I think in so many ways. Galileo was a remarkable guy. He was a philosopher. He was a mathematician. He was an astronomer. He was really involved in a lot of things. He did a lot of stuff. But he's best known for his basically presenting a heliocentric model of the universe. He was chief mathematician and philosopher in the court of Cosimo II de' Medici. Anybody familiar with the Medici family? They basically ran a lot of Europe. They were royalty in a lot of places. And Galileo had managed to get himself inserted into the court here of this Medician Grand Duke here. He was a consummate courtier, which meant that he knew how to insinuate himself, put himself into a royal court. Because, you see, a guy like Galileo, who was very bright and could do all kinds of great things, was broke. And what this illustrates is that science is expensive and you got to find somebody to pay for it, just the way it is today. If I want to do research, I got to go to the government. I write a grant to the National Institutes of Health, begging them for money, saying, I've got a great idea. You want to give me some money? It was just the same back then, except they didn't go to a government agency. They went right to a prince or a king. Somebody had a lot of bucks, and you would convince the prince or the king that you could do some really cool things for him, because a lot of these scientists, these early scientists, natural philosophers, were good at doing things like, improving telescopes or making a better compass for your navy or something useful. And so he convinced old Cosimo II that he could do stuff for him, and he took him in gladly. In order to stay in his good graces, he discovered that Jupiter had moons. He discovered what he called the stars of Jupiter. And he noticed that there were several of them. Well, he told the Grand Duke that God told him that he should name the stars after the Grand Duke. Can you say suck up? That's exactly what he did. He was very skillful at playing the courts at that time. He knew how to get the money by brown nosing, basically. And they called them the Medici stars. Go figure. All right, this will be the last slide, and we'll wrap up for tonight. He did ascribe to the Copernican model. He believed in a heliocentric arrangement for the universe. But this was actually out of vogue, because, as I said, for 1,500 years, everybody believed in the Ptolemaic model. Now, this means everybody believed in a geocentric model, with the Earth being at the middle of the universe. Church and secular scientists. Okay? This was just what everybody believed. So this meant that Galileo was going against the grain. All right? He had an uphill battle to fight. And it wasn't just the church. Now, the interesting thing is that the church sponsored these scientists. As a matter of fact, we're going to find out later that Galileo got in pretty chummy with the Pope, who sponsored some of his work. And that it was the church that supported these philosophers and natural scientists to explore the world around them, rather than, no. Don't talk to us about that nature stuff. We've got the Bible. That's all we need. The picture is very different than the one we're told. So we'll pick up next week. We'll finish up with Galileo and hopefully get into maybe a little apologetics if we got time. Thanks.